Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. It's a stormy day up in upstate New York. What can I say? The clouds are coming, but this should be fun. And welcome to Mystery Thursday. We have a ton of people on the air, and I am really excited. We have the author of Inheritance and Death, Joel Schiller. Yeah, we're going to find out what happens when you leave somebody a funeral home as a gift, an inheritance. Then we have Mark Schaff, Redemption Road. And if you really want to get scared about revenge and what happens when somebody takes matters into their own hands, you better read this with somebody with you because it's scary, but it's good. One of the best YA books I've ever read by Erica Sambooth, Code Crafters, and you'll meet Tag. And Elizabeth Rose, To the Last Petal Falls, that is totally, totally scary in itself. I'm telling you, if all these villains get together in all of these books, they would make one horror, let me tell you. It would be real scary. And we have one of my favorite authors in the world, New York Times bestselling author, John Land. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. And did I forget anybody? Why is there's like so many lights here, and I can't. I don't know. And Marcia's listening. I hear her. Marcia is listening to the show, too. We have a caller, and I don't know what kind of question he's going to ask. So if he calls in, we'll see what happens at the end. Okay. I would like to introduce John Land. And, John, would you tell everybody about your series and the new book that I didn't read yet that I have in the to-read pile?
Well, there's two.
My most recent series, the one that we've talked about a few times, features a female Texas Ranger named Caitlin Strong. And you always can tell the titles because they always start with the word strong, which is kind of the reason why I gave her that name. And then I've also resurrected my original series hero, Blaine McCracken, for a different publisher, an ebook publisher called a terrific company called Open Road Integrated Media, that had brought out my backlist with such success, long out of print, that I decided to resurrect the character, and he came out. Blaine returned last year in Pandora's Temple. He returns again starting on Christmas Eve in the 10th Circle. So Texas Ranger, Rambo-like Special Forces guy, kind of two different, entirely different series, but the thing they have in common is they're all thrillers.
Well, then that leads me to start with Mark. Because Mark Schaff's book, his character, well, sort of similar. So, Mark, you want to tell everybody about your book and this guy named Marcus who reminds me of McCracken a lot. Wait till you hear this. This is scary, let me tell you.
Thank you, Fran. My character, Marcus Diablo, is a protagonist who's sort of a regular kind of a guy. And he finds himself and his family in this situation where they are caught in the very beginning of this terrorist plot to attack the United States by using forest fires that start simultaneously from California to Connecticut in national parks and national forests. And it sets him on this journey to rectify a situation that arose within his family with his wife, and also to find the people responsible for the terrorist attack.
Okay, but tell everybody, he's so dangerous and he's go whatever. How does he manage to stay afloat? Why does he feel that he has to get even with whomever it was that did this? And how does he bring his sons into the plot?
I think the thing about, for me, about with heroes is that, And I guess the same would be with villains, is that they share these common values, and so they have this personal vested interest in trying to right a wrong. And for Marcus, once his wife is abducted, he sort of lets the normal chains of command work their way, the FBI, the police. When that all fails, he finds himself in a situation where he's the only one who can really go out and find out exactly what has happened to her. And in the process, he uncovers this plot that's been sort of simmering in the United States for over 30 years. In relationship to his sons, the family dynamic in my book is very important. So you have a husband and a wife with two young boys, and they're very close-knit. The boys are very independent, and the boys play a huge role in Marcus's motivation. In order for him to achieve his goal and to find the people responsible, he has to leave his sons. And by leave them, I mean he has to leave them in the care of a relative, and he travels to far corners of the world in search of these individuals who committed this heinous crime in the United States. And in doing so, he forms a bond with his sons. And the youngest son, Garrett, has a special bond with his mother. That was a bond that they had before birth. I sort of resist that there is a paranormal aspect to it, but I think that people that have a strong, close-knit family, and lots of times with children and their mothers, there is this almost supernatural kind of connection between the two.
Well, I'm hoping I can find my supernatural connection to my sister when I need her. I know.
I'm sure
that
you will be able to.
I often look up and I say to her, okay, Marcia Joyce, are you there? Just give me a sign or something. And sometimes you just never know. I know. Elizabeth, we have someone that has a question for you. So would you tell everybody about Erica, about Code Crafters? I'm going to say it this way. I ask the question sometimes and about you know, the ask in the chat room. If anyone asks a question that you don't feel comfortable with, then don't answer it. Yeah, it's an interesting question, that's why, because I've read your book. So tell everybody about Code Crafters and how you created Tag and the message that you might want kids to get when you created her.
Well, so this is a little different. It's a middle grade fantasy, which is for about 10 to 14-year-olds. And the purpose of this book is it's a fantasy book set in a world where you can actually program magic. So this whole sort of book came about in a very interesting way. I'm a computer scientist myself, and I was joking around with friends one day about, you know, what if you could actually program the real world? And, you know, about the rain, you could program the rain to fall, you could program the grass to grow, and what kind of world would that be like? And so Code Crafter takes place in this world where humans have started to understand the great potential of this, very similar to our own world. And the book is told in the protagonist Tag, who is a young girl who's coming to learn this sorcery for the first time. And what I really wanted to do writing this book was create a introduction to computer science that was a lot more gentle than a lot that I was seeing out there, and show children that about some of the really cool and creative stuff you could do with computers and likening it to magic. So the whole world has this flavor about where magic isn't what you are, but what you can build.
Well, then I have a very unusual question for you by a gentleman by the name of Ujjwal, and he's asking this question, and it's up to you whether to answer it. I know that very intelligent people are sometimes considered to be nerds. I know that because I was one of them, and that's okay. He has read your book, and he wanted to know if you thought about how nerds are looked upon within the United States and that if it was an issue that you tried to bring out in your book.
I'll answer that question.
I know you will. I don't think it's a bad question. It's an interesting question. Because somebody that might read the book might take it as, well, okay, fine.
Well, I think in the current years, I mean, we've had sort of a 180 on the idea of nerds in the United States.
Uh-huh.
I think you still have a lot of chagrin of being called a nerd, but you see a lot of very successful nerds going out there and doing great things. You have Zuckerberg with Facebook. You've got Steve Jobs, who, you know, sort of had a funeral in state last year, pretty much. So you see a lot of what it comes to the front of being a nerd is about, you know, being passionate about something, which I think we're starting to realize that the people who are passionate about things are the ones who go on to great careers and getting things done and doing really amazing things. So a lot of what I tried to do with Tilda and Tag was that being passionate about something and finding what you love to do doesn't make you a weak person. It makes you a strong person.
Okay, and now I'm going to move on to Joel. Joel, how did you come about to create a book where you left somebody a funeral home as a present? I thought that was different. I have to say that Joel put his book up. This is a very good site, people, Book Pleasures, and it's a site that I review for sometimes. I'm very selective as to what books I ask Norm for, and he has to give them to you. You don't just get the book. He has to approve that you fit the right title. So when I saw Inheritance and Death, I said, oh, interesting, a funeral home. What am I going to learn? So what made you think of creating that as your main thrust of your plot?
Well, I had written a screenplay many years ago in the 70s about midlife crisis, and I gave it to the film producers and directors, and they said, oh, how boring, everybody's writing that. Why don't you write something really original? So I came up with the idea of a story taking place in a funeral home involving necrophilia. I sent a screenplay to these producers, and they were absolutely horrified and outraged. Now, in the 21st century, this idea, I think, is much more palatable, and so I wrote the screenplay into a novel.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I got to read it. And how did you create those strange personalities within this funeral home? They're really weird.
I don't really know, because it just comes to me, you know. I mean, I've been in the movie industry, and I've done over 39 films as an art director. And so I've been around a lot and of films, you know, and see how they were written. So I don't, it just, I can't really explain how. I mean, you know, I'm just an artist, and if I like the idea that I'm doing, I just can add to it. I mean, I can't explain how these different people come to my mind.
It's just they just do as you're writing. And finally, Elizabeth, oh my God, yes. Till the Last Petal Falls, it's standing here. You get nothing from the cover, people, except my favorite flower, the rose. I love, my mother loved roses, and my sister did. And on my mother's gravestone, I put a red rose, believe it or not, because I just felt like it. And she loved it, yeah. My father used to give her one red rose every week. This is really, I mean, all it says on the back cover is, in the face of unspeakable madness, how powerful is love. When I read the book, I realized what that meant. So tell us about, give us a little hint, give everybody a little hint about this book. Because really, to tell you the truth, I was so pleasantly surprised. I had no idea what I was going to read. And then what happens is I read it in what you call Fran Zapp time. I couldn't put it down.
Hooray. That's the thing you want to get
down.
As an author.
Yeah.
Well, for a hint, I guess the biggest thing that I can use to describe it is that it is a modern retelling of Beauty and the Beast. And it is a modern retelling of Beauty and the Beast that tries to use this specific, very classic story that mostly, you know, American women grow up with as being one of the first fairy tales, one of the first stories that they really hear, and kind of using that in a way to ease people into a conversation about domestic violence, why women get into these situations, how they get into these situations, what we can do in a way where you have that base fairy tale kind of holding your hand through that discussion.
This if I tell you that main character, well, first of all, why would she take a job like that? And there were no red flags to tell her, oh my God, you better not do this. She just went and did it because she just, her first impression of this guy.
Right, and Jolie's a younger character. She's in her early 20s. And especially with the social climate right now, we're very much into this mentality of encouraging young people to take every opportunity they can and to really take risks. And Jolie, the main character, is a young woman who lives in a town that I grew up in, Highlands Ranch, Colorado, where everyone's very sheltered. It's a very sheltered city in which, you know, all of the streets are safe and all of the people, they may be obnoxious, but most of them are really nice and not really a lot of bad stuff happens in Highlands Ranch. And so she comes from this place where she's bored because she's been taught by society that life is full of excitement and danger, and you know, she takes this job because she doesn't have an understanding that the world is a lot darker than she knows it is. She's a privileged white girl from a very affluent city. And when she gets thrown into this excitement and danger, she realizes, oh my goodness, like, this excitement and danger is not fun. It's actually horrible and traumatic, and I wouldn't wish this on anybody. But she doesn't have that background information that would click those things for her, which is what I find in a lot of women from upper middle class families who do get in abusive relationships. They don't have that early conditioning to tell them that, hey, this could be happening to you, because we have too much of a societal expectation that abuse only happens to people of lower socioeconomic status or in certain parts of the country where, you know, this happens to her in a resort town in Colorado. That's something that you're not going to have that in the back of your head.
It was scary because after a while I began to think that she was in a trance or something and just didn't see her way clear to see past the cobwebs or past his face as to the fact that she was in some kind of danger. Which brings me to a general question, John, because you're the expert at this, not me. How would, when you create your villain and your hero, which character is more fun to create, the bad guy or the good guy? And how do you create the character traits of the bad guy? Because sometimes I root for the bad guy because it's so interesting. And sometimes you want the villain to come back again. So, John, how do you create? These are all really good authors, but new authors. And I think Mark, you're writing a sequel. I know that to scare me even more because I know you're bringing the guy back. I know that. And I'm sure that Diane's not even going to ask me. She's just going to send it. So, John, how do you create your villain, your bad guy, and your good guy, and how do you create a balance between them?
That is just a terrific question. And I'll use the example of Strong Rain Falling, a great question, where I have Caitlin Strong, who's an established character, so there isn't a lot of new development to do. There's always new challenges for her. But what I do to her in Strong Rain Falling is I give her the challenge of a fellow female as a villain, whose name is Ana Calles Gallardo, who's a Mexican billionaire. Now, the great thing about what I heard from Mark is he hit on the number one theme, if there's any, the number one motivating theme in fiction is revenge. Because villains or heroes, something has to motivate them, and that's the key. For a villain to really work, they have to believe in what the terrible things they're trying to do. Because that way the reader will believe in the terrible things they're trying to do. And they have to have their motivation has to be strong, their reasoning has to be strong, and their ability to pull it off. It all has to come together. Villains don't wake up every morning and say, how am I going to become the worst person in the world? They believe in what they're doing. They believe there's a purpose in what they're doing. And no matter how evil it is, the opening of Strong Rain Falling, the villain, the woman, murders five children in cold blood with herself. She doesn't have subordinates do it. She does it. Now, it happens off screen, so you don't see anything until later on when the bodies are found, and you know it was her who did it. But in her mind, she has a reason to commit this ultimate act of villainy. And what you do in a book when you create a character who kills, who does something that crosses the line, kills children, kills animals, kills innocent people of any kind. That's why terrorists make great villains. The thing is, the greatest villains are the ones who scare us. The greatest villains are the ones who are contemplating doing something that will change our lives and hurt our lives. And that's true of thrillers, because thrillers are about really bad people plotting really bad things that only one hero can stop from happening. If the thing they're trying to do doesn't scare the reader, doesn't get the reader to go, oh my God, if that happens, my life is really screwed, then you've created a villain who isn't scary enough, isn't desperate enough. But and you asked me about, is it more fun to create a villain or hero? Villains can be so much fun because you don't have to come back to them in future books, and you can take them right to the edge, which you can do with your heroes. The difference is you can't push your hero over the edge, but you can push your villain over the edge from a morality standpoint. And when you think of great literature, you think of great fiction, you think of great films, almost every great story, great heroes are made by great villains. There could be no Luke Skywalker without Darth Vader. There could be no Clarice Starling without Hannibal Lecter. There could be no, you know, and then we look at some of the greatest thrillers of all time. Day of the Jackal, centered on the villain. Eye of the Needle, centered on the villain. It goes, it's like a circle. And what you try to do structurally is you have this cat and mouse game where the villain's horrible, sinister plot is peeled away one step at a time by the hero or heroine, ultimately bringing them together where the hero is starting to realize what the villain is trying to do. And that is basically what defines a thriller as opposed to a mystery. In a mystery, the hero is trying to solve what's already happened. In a thriller, the hero is trying to prevent something much worse than what has already taken place from happening to a very large number of people in most cases.
Well, that really says it. When I write my next Faces book, I'm going to have to remember all of that when I write the bad guys. But Mark, your book and Joel's book also have, you know, villains. But your villain, would you call Marcus a combination of both?
I think I would. I think that like what John just said is that you can push your hero, you know, you can push your hero right to the very edge. And for me, I wanted to try to create a character that was a hero but was flawed. So I wanted my reader to be vested in Marcus in the very beginning of the book. And then as Marcus transforms himself, I wanted the reader to step back from him a little bit and question him and be a little disappointed in him, be a little maybe even disgusted by him. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I wanted the reader to come 180 degrees again and be full circle and be back in Marcus's camp. And so for me, the villain and the hero were both walking this gray area, this really fine line where it's a matter of perspective. So one man's hero is another man's villain, and the same is the other way. One man's villain could be another man's hero, depending on how we look at it and from whose perspective we look at it. I wanted the reader to look at my hero and go, there was a point where I wanted the reader to say, is he any better than that which he's trying to defeat?
Yeah, exactly. I did.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
I did at one point saying, okay, who's going to, you know, what else is he going to do? And is he going to get away with everything that he does? Because then how far can a hero go? I mean, a villain go to get away with it? In this particular case, I said, how far does the good guy actually go to get away with what he does that's bad? So which comes
you know, Fran, I think that Mark makes a great point, and this is something that you see more and more a trend in fiction today, and we can see this in real life. And that this is what, and that is traditional. When you look at great fiction and great villains, normally we're scared of them, but we don't have to worry because they don't live in our world. They live away from us, and they're not someone who can directly threaten our lives. But the latest fiction, the villains are living next door. The villains have, in the books of Harlan Coben and Lisa Gardner and other contemporary thriller authors, the monsters are living on Main Street. You know, and in real life, look at what happened in Cleveland with Ariel Castro, where he was holding three young girls hostage in his house in a cluttered neighborhood, and I was out there at that house. And there's literally only 20 feet, it's now demolished, 20 feet between it and the house on the left side and it on the house on the right.
That's scary.
And even though this is a tight-knit neighborhood, it went on for 10 years. The Boston Marathon surviving bomber, Johar Zarnaya, picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. What angers us about this more than anything, what fascinates us about this more than anything, is villains aren't supposed to look like this kid does. They're not supposed to be 19 years old. They're not supposed to look like they walked out of a boy band. We want our villains to be scarred and ugly and physically as evil as they are. We want their outsides to mirror their insides. But what we find in authors like Coben and Gardner and in real life is that's not true anymore. That in this crazy society that we now live in, where a lot of us don't even know the names of our neighbors, do we really know what's going on inside any of these houses? Do we really know who's living next to us and what they may be doing in their basements? John Wayne Gacy played a clown at birthday parties and murdered at least 38 young boys that he buried in his basement. The bind, torture, kill, the BTK killer, was a scoutmaster. So the villains, and this is what I really took from what Mark just said, they're living among us. And that's what makes it really scary. That's why books, the great thrillers, don't need to threaten the entire world. They just need to threaten a neighborhood, a family, a person. Because a villain is not defined by the scope necessarily of what they're trying to do. The villain is defined by the capacity for the evil they can do, even only to one person.
Well, you know what? We have Adam in Elizabeth's book, and he fits the category of a gorgeous guy, and you would look at him, right? And on the outside, he's gorgeous, but you can sort of, as you were describing him, I could feel that there was more to him. So what made you, how did you create this guy that had to live by himself for whatever reason, which we won't give away, because you guys want to read this, it's spooky. How did you create him, well, did you create him as being this gorgeous man so that Jolie would just, like, fall at his feet?
I wanted him to be very much he's a stereotype of the average abusive partner.
Yeah.
Someone who, to the outside, and it's hard to do that when you're trying to do a retelling of a story where the hero or the, you know, romantic lead has to be isolated, the surface reason for that. There's the whole other reason for it. So, you know, in actual abusive relationships, you see these women who are in a relationships that people from the outside see as being wonderful, happy relationships. There was a wonderful ad campaign a couple of weeks ago, and where they show a beautiful wedding photo with a beautiful man and a beautiful woman. But then the other side of the ad campaign is you turn the picture around and he's holding her arm in a wrestling, like, bar in the back. And he's hurting her in the back to show that, like, there are people who are in abusive relationships that they're not the people that, like, you walk by and you go, oh, that guy obviously beats his wife at night. That's not what happens. What happens is you see your girlfriend and you say, oh, you're so lucky to have a beautiful boyfriend. You're so lucky to have such a loving husband. And then when the doors are closed, you know, that woman has this mentality of, well, everyone's telling me he's such a good person. How am I wrong? Instead of immediately going, oh, my God, this person is deplorable and needs help. Joey sees that Adam is a beautiful man, and he's smart, he's intelligent. He's got a weird, quick wit about him. He pretty much fulfills the romantic lead, but he's slightly off. But she immediately turns that on herself of, oh, I must be the one who's seeing something wrong here. I'm not looking at him deeply enough. I'm the one who's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Where in reality, he's the one who's wrong.
I know, and he's got a staff around him that's so afraid of him that alone should have told her. Now, Joel, in your book, we've got your own type of villain, but you've got some really colorful characters. So tell everybody about Rice. He's kind of not when Jeff comes to the funeral home. He's not exactly greeted, you know, like, oh, we're so glad that you're here to take over. They were sort of hostile to him. How come? How come they were hostile to him? They weren't exactly glad to see that he was taking over the funeral.
Oh, well, of course.
They didn't exactly give him a warm welcome. At which point, I think they probably would have liked to put him in one of the coffins and take him out.
Well, of course. Well, I mean, these people have been there a long time, and one of the chief people that have been there the longest was very close to the owner who just recently died, and this person expected to inherit this. And at one point, there was a will where the owner was leaving it to this man, Emmett Royce, but he didn't get it. And that's part of the trick in the mystery, because why didn't he inherit it like he thought he would? The other people, you know, to work in a funeral home, if you ask what do people think about, who are the people that might be villains in the book, well, you know, the average person would rather wash dishes in a restaurant kitchen than work in a funeral home.
So I
feel that all these people are suspicious, it seems to me. You know, I don't have personal history of this, but I do think that it is that way. And this Jeff, originally his parents died and his uncle took him over when he was just 14 or 15, and he brought him up in this funeral home. So Jeff was just hated the idea that he would have to go back there. But he does, for other reasons that are happening to him in Hollywood. And so he leaves Hollywood, and he accepts this inheritance. And then people try to do away with him. So it's a character that is interesting, because he's just like you and I. I mean, you know, he just all of a sudden is thrown into this weird, you know, atmosphere.
Well, let's go a little one step further into this villain person. When you create a villain, anyone that wants to take it, what characteristics do you go into when you're creating the villain? Now, Erica, you have a villain in your story too, but in a different way, right?
Yeah. So, in my book, it's sort of interesting that you see in a lot of children's literature that you have the very stereotypically evil guy with a capital E.
Yeah.
But what I try to do with Tag's story is that in any other book, I mean, Tag would be considered probably the bad guy. Her father is called the Dreadlord.
He's
attacking the queen.
Yeah.
And so a lot of Tag's problems stem from her father having started this war against the ruling queen, and the queen seeing that, well, you know, Tag would be a very good bargaining piece if she could be captured. So, you know, Florian's out to do that. So consequently, you have a situation where neither one of these guys is particularly a villain. They're just doing what they think is right. And even Tag's father does have reasons for doing what he thinks is the best thing to do. So a lot of it, the pieces that come together there are really characters that think they're doing the right thing, and the trick is to have them come into conflict with each other through those similar goals. So Gloria actually doesn't appear on screen or on page at all in this book, though
yeah.
her reach is felt. And so even the guard captain, who's sort of the corporeal arm of Queen Floria's reach,
mm-hmm.
is really just doing his job. And even if he's kind of a jerk about it, you know, he can be seen to be sympathized with at a given point, which I think is a lot of the situations that children find themselves in between 10 and 14, where they have authority figures that they generally come into contention with somehow, but it's not really because the authority figure hates them or is trying to, you know, make their life miserable. It's because this is, you know, how they see that it's just the best way to do things for these children. So having a situation like that was pretty fun to write.
The father sort of stifles her too. She decides to speak up for herself. He tells her respect, blah blah blah. But after a while, she learns that she has to speak out. But we won't tell anybody why. So, question mm-hmm. to everybody: here's an interesting one that I just created as I'm sitting here. I write a lot and I send questions out, and then I say, well, how can I make this a little bit more interesting? When you create the dialogue between the villain and the hero, how do you create the dialogue between the villain and the hero to keep the plot moving so that the villain, you know, might win out in one scene, and then the hero, well, thinks he's going to win in the next scene, but guess again. So how do you create that dialogue between the bad guys and the good guys? And anyone?
Well, for me, this is Mark. For me,
oh, good.
It's all about conflict. There has to be this conflict that pushes the hero. It constantly has your hero moving towards his goal. And so, if we can keep that conflict alive, and as we know, as we try to write, and I'm sure that John knows better than the rest of us, is that, you know, showing is much better than telling. And so, in dialogue, if we can create that conflict where the hero is being pushed in dialogue by the villain, that keeps that conflict alive. That keeps that conflict foremost in the reader's mind.
Well, Mark, we have a question in the chat room, and it's a really good one. And it's from Jonah Viles, and he said, I thought that Marcus had a great love story, not just between his kids, but his beloved Annie. Was that your intent when you wrote it?
It was my intent. One of the things that I've sort of come to realize now that the book's out and I'm marketing it is that how my book appeals to women. And the characters in my book are primarily men. The protagonist is a man. And so when I wrote the book, I did have this idea that I wanted the character to have this love story between him and his wife. And I wanted it to be written in a way that I think that if I generalize, you know, women would like to think that there's a man out there who would go to the ends of the earth for them, that he would lay down his very life for them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how realistic that is, I don't know. But I wanted the character to kind of have that feeling, like here mm-hmm. was a man who would be willing to go to the end of the earth for the love of his life. And in terms of his sons, that is how the love between the character and his wife is kept alive. Because even though the wife is not alive any longer, the love between the two of them is kept alive through the sons. And
yeah.
And I think that the book, I hope that the book does that. As a reader, I hope that that's what readers get from it.
It does, but you play that was a strange twist. I'll tell you that, because normally you would never figure that that would be what would happen to the main character. So as I read it, I had to stop reading to get a box of tissues.
Aww.
Which was because when he describes what happens to Annie, it's really typical of what you see in a terrorist attack on television. And that's all I'll say
mm-hmm.
about that. It was really, really scary. So anybody else want to take that question? How do you create the balance, the conversation between the villain and the hero? And would anybody ever make the hero lose the battle? I ask difficult questions. I don't mean to. Would anybody ever bring the villain back again for another shot at the hero?
Yes. Sorry, that was like a really quick answer. I actually have a plan for one of my villains to come back later as a hero after being properly rehabilitated.
Well, that's good, because when I can't wait for the sequel to your book too, and I had no idea what that was about either, basically. And I'm reading, I'm going to go, co-crafters, computers, whatever, okay. And like I said, it's really good. Before I got on the show, my nephew Jake, wherever you are, if you're listening, you're getting this one. For making me help you with your vocabulary homework last week for 3 hours after we did it and worked on it. And I've got a few more for the other two nephews because they've been, you know, torturing their aunt too. But that's okay, because that's why I'm here.
John, I think listening to everybody, when we think about villains and listening to what the other writers have said, it makes me think that if you can do one of two things or both, if either the villain and hero already have some connection between them that comes out in the course of the writing, or the villain reveals, makes the hero understand or realize something about themselves. In The Tenth Circle, which is the book I have, the Blaine McCracken book I have coming out on Christmas Eve, I did something entirely different. Normally, my villains are all powerful people with unlimited resources who can build armies. They can do whatever they want. Great villains make great heroes. So that's the direction I've always gone in. But for the Tenth Circle, I did something different. I based my villain on that crazy Florida preacher who burned Korans, because what that guy made me realize was that a small guy with a little mind and no power at all can do great damage in the world. He burned Korans in front of 50 people, and the whole world caught fire. There were riots and protests. American soldiers died in Afghanistan because of this Koran burning that he did. And I said, you know what? It's time to create a villain in my books who doesn't have unlimited resources, who doesn't have all this power. And what that makes McCracken has always gone up against Bond-like villains with secret underworld societies and lairs and all that kind of thing. And in this book, he realizes that his role is different now, that all heroes now like him, because ultimately McCracken is a superhero like Rambo. He has to look in different places for the bad guys. Because like I said before about the bad guys, the villains living next door to us, so too is the fact that a villain in today's internet age, in an age where anybody can say anything they want and reach the entire world at any time, you don't need unlimited resources. All you need is a laptop and an internet connection.
Yep. That is so true. I mean, you can even look up the word villain. You can even look up how many stories or pictures of villains. I went to they were created a cover for the new book that I have, actually have a horror story in for the very first time. It's called Satan's Hell, Welcome to My Nightmare. Welcome to Your Nightmare. And when I looked at the cover, I was like, oh my God, she got it so right. She created a picture of Satan, and everybody has their own, you know, viewpoint, a picture of it. And when I looked at it, a cover, I mean, just in general, just from the cover of each of your books, you get a different kind of feeling. When I looked at Elizabeth's book, you get this dead rose on the front. You look at Code Crafters, and you're looking at this young girl in the front. When you're looking at Mark's book, it's a totally different kind of scene. It almost looks like a fire. on the front cover. And when you look at Joel's book, you've got like a funeral home on the cover. So brings me to my next area of questioning. When you decide the setting of the book or where it takes place, how do you decide the setting and how do you decide to depict that setting on the cover of the book? Because the setting is vital to any book. Of course, that book can take place anywhere but the funeral home. Or Mark's book took place someplace. How did you decide where you should put your story? Anybody?
Well, you know, for me, I guess a lot of writers, especially those of us who this is, mm-hmm. if it's a first novel or the first time you've had a novel published, you write mm-hmm. what you know. So
yeah.
I picked settings that I was mm-hmm. intimately familiar with, places mm-hmm. that I've been, places close by that I'd been. You know, you mentioned the town in Colorado
yeah.
where you grew up.
Yeah.
So you use places you know, and that sort of gives you the context. And then in terms mm-hmm. of finding a cover that fits that, for my book it was just dumb luck. I was working with an artist to try to come up with a cover, and he suggested that I look at photographs, and I went and searched photographs of forest fires because it's a huge element in my book, and I found this photograph that it couldn't have been any better. It was just the perfect picture, the perfect cover for the book. And once you read the book, the picture of the fire and the river, it makes perfect sense. And so in context, it worked just great. But setting the book, I wrote what I knew. I just took where I'd been and things that I'd done in my life, activities that I'd done, and I wove the story accordingly.
Yeah. I would definitely agree.
Go on.
Like I said, Highland Ranch is where I grew up, and I mean, for me, when I started even planning what kind of story I wanted to write and what I wanted to write about, in terms of setting, I actually chose that I wanted, when I decided I wanted to write novels, I chose that I wanted to write things. The whole entire novel takes place in Colorado, mostly around the Highlands Ranch, Denver area, because in reading stories from where I am, and I'm a huge believer in that you only become a good author when you write what only you can write. I found that there is a lot of Colorado lit. A lot of Colorado lit was very... it was either based in the frontier kind of times and back when everything was mountains, or everybody's up at a ski resort, and there's not very much literature about what it's like to actually live in Colorado as a Coloradan.
No, it's interesting. How did you decide, Erica, where to place Tag? Because that's a different kind of setting and in a different world, you might say.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely say that since it is a fantasy book, I mean, I'm not really writing from experience there, you could say. What turned out to be the factor with setting this in a medieval fantasy world was, so it wasn't necessarily a matter of place, it was a matter of time. And mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people come up to me and they're like, you're writing a computer book, why did you set it basically in the Middle Ages? That seems weird. And the answer I've sort of come up with for that is that the technology is complicated enough as it is, and if you spend a lot of time, you know, trying to set up, you know, this context in a realistic world, you get bogged down with a lot of details. What I wanted to do was sort of showcase a lot of the joy and freedom that comes from being able to program and to create things on your own. And a lot of kids, you know, you tell them that and they say, okay, magic, which fits itself very nicely into the medieval fantasy world, which whenever I was building sort of the society, I wanted to put it on the brink of a technological revolution, which is in many ways reflective of, I think, where we are now. And so a lot of that sort of turned into the direction of where the book takes, about, you know, exploration and discovery as opposed to, you know, a conflict of a real bad guy. A lot of the book turns into, you know, what new things can we do whenever we figure stuff out in the world, and how do we make life better for other people. So that's sort of the direction that I've pushed forward that way, because I think it's an interesting sort of mirror to our present day situation.
That's true, because you could probably do a lot with this and even bring it in into present day situations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, as I'm sitting here writing again, if you would take this book, even though it's in medieval, and sort of flashback to someone in the present, or maybe someone in the present that took a flashback to someplace in the past, and create two different worlds with characters doing the same thing.
Well, a lot of the book is, in many ways, so sort of a satire on a lot of the technological world right now. People who are familiar with computers and programming will recognize the Lang monsters as all being programming languages,
mm-hmm.
like Java and C.
Yeah.
a lot of the structures that are in place there do have mirrors in our own world, which partly what I wanted to do was create a bit of familiarity. So parents who, you know, might be software engineers can read the book as a satire. Their children then, you know, read this book, and then whenever maybe they get into a programming class in school, some of these concepts they would be able to fall back on in the book and say, oh, that's just like the Lang monsters. I understand that intuitively, and this technology isn't so scary right now.
Joel, how did you decide on the setting? I mean, did you do any research or anything? Did you go into a funeral home and actually see how it was run before you wrote this? Or this just came to you?
Well, yes, I have. One of the things I like the idea of listening to everybody is I'm learning that, you see, my character is an everyday man, and he gets thrown into a very uncomfortable situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he develops, and you're rooting for him, like anybody who reads this would think that they're like this guy, and all of a sudden he's thrust into a funeral home. And but my research, you know, I have to tell you, I was the art director on Rosemary's Baby. I learned an awful lot from Roman Polanski.
Whoa.
And so, and he taught me, what I learned from him was...
Well, I suddenly lost everybody.
I learned from him is that if you have everyday people, like in Rosemary's Baby, it was just a married couple that just sort of got married, and they rented an apartment, and unusual, weird things happened to them. And so I learned about that, and I learned about fright and terror from Roman. And I even came up with a suggestion that was used in the film about this kind of, you know, putting an average person in a horrible, frightening situation.
Mm. Oh, my God. That must have been so interesting. That was such a scary movie. I had to close my eyes when I was watching it. I don't like too scary. What can I say? But you don't expect what's going to happen. So I got to tell you this.
I was married, and my wife was pregnant, and I was given the script, and so we went to San Diego for the weekend, and here I'm reading Rosemary's Baby, and my wife is pregnant. And
oh,
I
my
was,
God.
I'm laughing now, but I was kind of horror-struck by reading this script.
I would be horror-struck, too. Oh, my God. Okay, so next question, because we have a couple more minutes. We have time. Besides the setting and the cover, because the cover, I was talking to Mark's publicist last week, and I interviewed Diane, and Diane said that the most important thing about a book is the title of the book. And I found that to be quite true, because she said if the title doesn't get readers, when you walk into a bookstore, a lot of times they look at the cover and the title. So how do you feel about, do you think that the title brings in readers? Do you think that is what does it? And how
well,
did you decide on your
it,
titles? Yeah.
I think a title like The Inheritance of Death should grab people. You know, that's my own personal feeling.
I think the title has to grab people. That's the whole idea, right?
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
titles are important. This is John again. Titles are part of how an author brands not only their book but themselves, especially if you're doing a series. The title should reflect this, and this was actually discovered by accident. This was back in, with CBS, which became Fawcett Gold Medal and Random House eventually, when John D. McDonald was writing the Travis McGee stories. And he had done one, I think he had done one that had a color in it. And they were trying to figure out what to call the second one. And they said, well, let's just put another color in. And then that created a brand for him. So every one of the Travis McGee novels is branded by a color. Every one of Sue Grafton novels is branded by a letter. Mm. Every one of Janet Ivanovich's is branded by a number. So I created Caitlin Strong specifically because I knew her last name being Strong, I would have Strong in all the titles. Now, I wasn't expecting to have Strong being the first word in all the titles, but to the point that I'm making, once I did it twice, I'm then sort of committed to doing it because you're actually making the publisher's job a lot easier. See, as writers, we can't just be people who sit, we can't just be storytellers anymore. We have to be marketers. We have to basically serve up a smorgasbord for our publisher to make life as easy as possible for them. Now, Sue Grafton's going to run out of letters. She's the number one New York Times bestseller. She'll figure something out. You know, Robert Ludlum didn't necessarily have a brand in his titles, but he basically invented the three words, the blank blank. That became Ludlum's thing. The Monterey Circle, the Holcroft Covenant, to the point when I was represented by his agent for a while, the one thing his agent told me I couldn't do was have a Ludlum-like title because then I'd be imitating another one of his clients. So that, to me, is what you think of. And I get in testy discussions with writers sometimes when I explain that you never write a book that you don't know how to sell. Because you, like any other product, you don't create it unless you can sell it. The title is crucial to that. The cover is crucial to that.
Yeah.
The design, the where everything flows, the you know, it's all crucial and it's all part of branding. And that's what we all need to do. Because if you're going to have only one book, you're not going to have a career. And if you're going to build your career on the first book that you've written, you need to start thinking of your brand with that first book, because if it's successful, you're going to want to do another one in the same series. You're going to want to expand that, and that's what you're going to come back to. That's what's crucial as writers. We have to know how to sell ourselves.
Well, you know what? A lot of people, you know, post on Facebook, but that helps to a point, not really, and Twitter. And I post reviews on Scoop.it, and people follow them. I post on Tumblr, and I'll post on Red Room, and I'll post on a lot of different sites that a lot of people don't post on. Before we go, how do you market your book? How do you get people to know it's out there? And I know that pretty much everyone is writing something in a series. So the character that you've created, Mark, you created Marcus, and then there's Tag. And Elizabeth, I don't know if you're bringing Jolie back for a sequel or anything. And I know that Joel's going to bring Jeff back. I know that. And I know John's going to bring back Caitlin soon, I hope, because, you know, I like her.
For sure.
I know that. So how do you other than Facebook and Twitter and all the normal places, what do you think is the best place for people to get to know your books? Because book signings and stuff like that seem to have gone the way of the wind for some reason.
You know, I hate to dominate, but I think here's the crucial thing to think about.
Yeah.
It's not so much how to sell the book out. And what I mean is to the consumer. You have to first figure out how to sell the book in, which means how do you get stores to display it?
Put it in,
how do you get people to pay attention to it? How do you get Amazon to notice it? Now, there are people, you know, we've all heard the stories about authors who have put up hundreds of fake reviews.
Yep.
They arrange for these fake reviews on Amazon. And for a while, that was very successful until Amazon caught on. And now they've programmed it into their server to recognize somehow when you're getting all these block reviews that are all one paragraph, all five stars.
Yeah, I know.
And all say essentially the same thing. And if I had the answers to what I just said, I'd be a lot more successful than I am. Because everybody wants that front store display space in a bookstore. And everybody
yep.
wants Amazon to email blast their 30 million book buyers about your book. Because if they do that, and it's priced right, your book's going to sell just because it's promoted that way. So I wish I had the answers for how to do that. A lot of times it's money. But the bottom line is every publisher is willing to spend the money to a program. But since they all want to do it, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the independents are able to become very selective in which books they choose to promote. Because it's very difficult, and this is where I'll end, it's very
yeah.
difficult to successfully sell a book out if it's not properly sold in.
Well, you know what I do, and I don't know if anybody else is. My husband gets totally embarrassed, but I do it anyway because I don't care. If I go into Staples, which I am tomorrow, to get a copy of the second edition of MJ Magazine, which is coming out, I hope, at the end of the month, I usually take a couple of copies of my books and I give them to the people that work there. Yeah, even if they don't want them, I give it to them anyway because they usually do want them. No, seriously. When I get like 50 or 60 books that I've read in a month or so and I'm giving them away to the people in this building, you know, that I live in, that, like you said, you don't know who lives there. I don't know anybody's name, but I know they like my books because I put them in the laundry room and in 10 minutes they're all gone. I stick a couple of mine in there too. You know, I went into the post office the other day and the lady said to me, what did you bring? And I go, here, have a copy of this. Robert DeGoni said that when he goes on a plane, he brings copies of his books. So I figured, you know what? I can walk down the street. I went into the bagel place or the bakery and then gave the lady working there copies of my books because you don't know who you're giving it to. You don't know who's going to get it. So that's one way. I also know that when you go on Amazon and check out your own title a couple of million times, you can post the link on Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter and stuff. And after a while, they get to notice it. So once in a while, you may get an email. If you need something great to read, Bad Choices by Fran Lewis is a great book. Or the new one, Liars, Betrayal, and Fear, that came out last Tuesday is a great one. You just never know. You're right. So does anybody else have any great marketing tips that they want to share?
I don't have any great marketing tips, but I think that, you know, listening to what John said about selling the
yeah.
book in
yeah.
and making sure that you have a plan to do that is really, really important. I mean, one of the things about writing is that the writing is relatively the easy part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can sit down, it's just you and the words, and you can do your thing. It's the marketing. It's getting to a place where you have an opportunity to participate in a show like this, Fran, and where that opportunity is even available to a writer. And for me, the only thing out there that distinguishes my writing from anyone else is me.
Yeah.
And I feel really strongly about putting myself out there at every opportunity I get to talk about my book, to talk with other writers about what they've done. And just like you, I have books that I carry with me everywhere I go. Mm-hmm. And I leave books everywhere I go. Doesn't
yeah.
matter where it is. If I see someone at the gym who's reading, I will walk out to my car and grab a book, and I'll walk in and I'll interrupt them and I say, hey, I see you're reading, and I'll give them a copy of my book. But at the end of the day, I need people to go out, people that I don't know, people that have never met me, to buy my book. And trying to get that book in so that people display it, people talk about it, I find that the best way to do that is simply just man up and go ask. And all they can tell me is no.
Yeah, well, you know, it's what happens when you go into the libraries around here in New York City. It's hard. Up here where I am now, They have to approve the book, whatever. But what you can do at times is I went to, they had a book fair. So I donated a couple of my Bertha and Tilly Sisters Forever that I wrote. And I said to the lady, I know you're only selling it for a dollar, whatever, but here, have a couple of copies of the book. I don't know if she sold them or whatever, but they weren't there the next time when I came, when they did the same thing. Sometimes there's a bin in the library that you can just put a book in. And you never know, if they like it, they might actually put it on the shelf and they might actually buy more. You just don't know. The problem is that with self-published authors, they won't take them in the libraries up here, which is really wrong. They figure that a self-publishing company will publish just about anything. And even though my last three books are traditionally published, it's a small press print. It comes up as POD anyway, so they're looking at it as self-publishing or print on demand, even though it's not. So let's go around and ask, Elizabeth, what's next for you? What's your next title? What's coming out next for you? Is Elizabeth there? Hello?
I'm here.
Okay. Mark, what's your next title?
Next title is Saint or Sinner, and it's a continuation of the first book, Marcus with Mark Diablo. Hopefully it's I've written it as a standalone, so it's going to go to edit here in about a month, and so I hope that that's how it comes off. But it will be it'll pick up right where the first book ends.
And
so it will sort of be a continuation of the same set of characters, and we'll see. I think there's I left a lot of undeveloped characters there. I left a lot of undeveloped situations. There's a lot of subject matter there to write. I could get several books out of it.
I'm sure you will. And what's next for Tag, Erica? What's her next feat?
Well, I won't spoil it quite, because I think her next deeds are pretty closely tied with the resolution of Codecrafter, but she's still got a lot to learn at Tilda, and I'm hoping to introduce some new fun programming concepts into her world that should be pretty interesting, including recursion and networking. So I'm still working on the draft, and I'm not sure what it'll be called yet, but it's been fun so far.
Well, that is good. And Joel, what's next for these poor people in the funeral home? What are you going to do with them?
Well, my next book is called The Death of the Adored.
Oh, gosh.
And it's about a woman. It's about a woman. She is the villain, but she's also adored by everybody. So it's a mixed thing. And it's one of the few mysteries I've put together, or, you know, read, where she could be guilty of murdering elderly women, but at the same token, it could just be they were old and they would die anyway. So that's why I call it The Death of the Adored, because she's loved by everyone, and nobody can see anything negative about her.
Did we get Elizabeth back? Are you here? I don't know what happened to her. Her phone is on, but I guess maybe she hung up. I'm not sure. Okay. And John, besides the 10th Circle, what's Caitlin's next adventure?
Strong Darkness.
Okay.
And that'll be out next September, just about a year, a little less than a year from now.
Oh, that is good. I love it. So if you could choose, before we close, which character do you like better, the bad guy or the good guy?
I would say the
good guy.
Yes.
What?
The good guy.
You like the good guy?
You got to love the good guy. Yeah.
You got to love the good guy. And in Mark's case, you have to love him because he's both good and bad.
Yeah, I think so.
Ambiguity. You know, I think good guys I like the better characters, the good people, because someone said before, I think it was Mark, about having characters defined by their flaws as much as by their strengths. And with great heroes, there is room for gray. Things are not black and white anymore. But with great villains, the more you give them gray shades, the more you dilute their villainy. It's kind of like the Richard III thing from Shakespeare where, well, he was abused, he was rejected, he was crippled, so, oh, poor me, I can get away with anything I want. I can kill my two cousins, my two children, you know, my two nephews, whatever they were in the tower. I can do whatever. So there's, it isn't as easy as you get to know villains better. You start to relate to them more and you start to realize, and this is true, I started off, when we started talking and I mentioned Johar Tsarnaev and I mentioned his picture and the Rolling Stone article. When you read that article, you feel bad for him. And you stop thinking of him as a villain and you start seeing him as a messed up kid who made a terrible choice. But that makes us forget, or could make us forget, that he put a bomb-laden backpack in front of an 8-year-old boy. That's irredeemable. And yet we want to save him, because when you see all the terrible things that happened in his life, you feel that if you had known him, if he had been someone in your life, you could have stopped this from happening. But that removes a crucial part of fiction from the paradigm, from the model. So I like to push my characters to the edge, as I said before. I like my heroes to learn more and more about themselves and to expand who they are and grow emotionally and age chronologically. Villains are much less dimensional than that, because the more you develop them, the less evil they become.
That's interesting. So I'm going to announce that next Thursday I'm going to be interviewing New York Times bestselling author, he's a new author, Justin Kramen, the Preservationist. And his main character and Adam and Mark go to get together. That's all I'm going to say. It's scary. Oh, trust me, it's scary. The following week, I am totally blown away that I am going to be interviewing one of the number one bestselling authors in the world, Carlyn Eggers.
She's terrific.
She is, I can't believe it, yes. Her publicist contacted me. She loved what I did with DeClan's Cross. It's the first book. And, yes, she agreed to do the second author on October 24th. And the first author is Alan Vassberg, and he wrote a book called The Inspirer, and it's poems. After that, I am taking a break for a while in order to deal with an issue that I don't want to deal with, but I have to. Okay, Marcia is telling me that Willow and Jeff Glaze on The World of Ink, this is The World of Ink, have a paranormal show at 9 p.m. Central Time, 10% Eastern Time, Tracy Ford. And Marcia is on The World of Ink, and she goes, a good story is a good story. And you never know what's going to happen when the two of us get together on the same show. You just don't know. What can I say? So I'm going to be doing next week and the week after, and then I'm not going to be doing anything until the end of November. We're going to see what happens. Okay, also, Virginia Grenier and Marcia, Monday night at 9 o'clock. This is important because October is Breast Cancer Month. They will be doing a show on breast cancer, and those of you that have input, they would be more than happy to have you in the chat room, and I don't know if they take calls. You're very welcome. And without Marcia and Virginia, I wouldn't be on the air. What can I say? They are the World of Ink. I'm just here doing whatever. I want to thank everyone for being on the show today. I want to thank Joel and Elizabeth and Mark and John and Erica. Thank you so very much. And please make sure that whenever the sequel comes out, that it's mine first.
Okay.
Because I have been noted to do back covers and stuff like that, yes. And I was just surprised by someone that sent me a book where I was on the back cover and giving a quote. So thank you to my friend Rick Fudoyan, who wrote The Torturous Me, because he gave me a blurb on the back of the book. And I was really kind of excited. Ever so often, you never know. And I do want to thank Mark Rubenstein and Anne Stanmore, my editor Maxine Bringenberg, and Karen Vaughn for doing the phenomenal back cover on my new book that came out October 1st, Lies, Betrayals, and Fears, Faces Behind the Stones 3. And for those of you that buy it, you would be helping me find the cause of Alzheimer's in memory of my mom and my sister. And on that note, I want to thank everyone. Have a very, very, very good evening. And we're going to be doing another one of these in January. And I will let you know. So if anybody has another book, I think author Larry Thompson is going to be with us that day. And anybody else that wants to come on, just let me know. So everybody have a good night. And I just got an email from Carla Negus, publicist, to confirm whatever time. I'm going to give her 3 o'clock. That sounds good. And thank you, John, a million times. And I will see you again on November 20th for our surprise show. And I can't tell you why. It's a secret.
I don't even know.
Something good. He doesn't know. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I just invited some people to be on the show, and I will email the rest because it's a secret. It's going to be whatever happens, happens. And it's on my new show on Red River Radio. It's called Chat Time with Fran, and it's going to be November 20th at, I think I said 4 o'clock. I'm not even sure. And it's going to be filled with surprises. That's all I'm going to tell you. So have a nice night, and good night, everybody. Bye.
Good night, Fran.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.